You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Good evening and welcome back to Psychiatry Today with Dr. Scott. This is your host, Dr. Scott Bay, with all the latest mental health related news, including everything about the mind, the brain, human behavior, how to feel well emotionally, how to cope better with stress, how to rid yourself of bad habits, how to improve your relationships, and helping you make sense of media reports on the latest research into the causes and potential new treatments for mental illness. Along the way, better informing the general public about mental health issues and trying to reduce the stigma associated with having a psychiatric diagnosis and needing treatment for it. All of that delivered to you without the hype and distortion of other media sources and with the benefit of more than 20 years in the practice of psychiatry. And welcome again to this podcast, which was pre-recorded for airing on Wednesday, September the 21st, 2016. And I hope that you've been feeling well mentally and emotionally lately. We're going to start tonight's podcast with certainly a mental health related story having to do with the brain and how it functions and cognitive functions, and specifically how that relates to one of the biggest problems in terms of distracted driving. Now, the study wasn't about texting and driving. However, the research shows why, if you didn't already realize it, that's not a good idea whatsoever. Well, this research does give us clues as to how the brain works and give us insights in case you needed convincing as to why texting and driving doesn't work. When we're busy with something that requires the use of sight, the brain reduces hearing to make it easy for us. This is the conclusion of a study conducted by researchers from Linköping University. The results give researchers a deeper understanding of what happens in the brain when we concentrate on something. The brain is really clever and helps us to concentrate on what we need to do. At the same time, it screens out distractions that are extraneous to the task. But the brain can't cope with too many tasks. Only one sense at a time can perform at its peak. That is why it's not a good idea to talk on the phone while driving, much less text while driving. Researchers have investigated what happens in our brains when we are occupied by a visual task. One example is a student taking an exam, while another is a person driving a car. The researchers also wanted to see how concentration changes when the background noise increases. 32 students took part in the study, which has been published in the journal Frontiers in Human Neuroscience. The students were given a visual task to work on, some of them in calm surroundings, and others with distracting background noise. Images of their brains were taken with a functional MRI camera while they worked. The difference between functional MRI or fMRI and the common MRI that you would see at your local hospital or imaging center, and perhaps you've had such a study done, maybe when you hurt yourself or were ill, is that functional MRI doesn't merely look at a static picture of the structure of whatever part of the body is in the scanner. It can actually give you real-time information as to the functioning of whatever you're looking at. So if you are doing an fMRI scan of someone's brain and they're performing a certain task or thinking about certain thoughts, you can actually see what parts of the brain are more or less active. The researchers also tested the function of the student's short-term memory using a memory test with letters. The results show that brain activity in the auditory cortex, which controls hearing, continues without any problems as long as we are subjected to sound alone. But when the brain instead is given a visual task, such as a written exam, the response of the nerves in the auditory cortex decreases and hearing becomes impaired. As the difficulty of the task increases, the nerve's response to sound decreases even further. A high cognitive load in the form of a visual task thus impairs the brain's response to sound, not only in the outer part of the brain, the cortex, but also in the parts of the brain that deal with emotions. This is information that is not involved with solving the task. This is basic research into how the brain works, and the results suggest many possible paths for further work. The knowledge gained may be important in the future design of things like hearing aids. Another possibility is that the research will form the basis for work looking into how impaired hearing influences the way in which we solve visual tasks. But above all else, it also gives us important basic clues into how if you're visually engaged with something, it impairs the other senses. Thus, not only is it inappropriate to try to talk on the phone and drive or text and drive, indeed, it gives us evidence that the whole concept of multitasking is illusory. And there's lots of other research that more directly shows that. But when you're doing one thing, focus on that. You're going to do it better than if you're doing that along with one or more other things. We may think that we can handle multiple things at once, and indeed we may function that way. Indeed, we may have to function that way, given the demands of our job and other things going on. But still, when we're doing that, we're not doing any one of those tasks as well as if we focused on it, just one at a time. All right, so there you go. If you still thought it was okay to text and drive, and I can't fathom why anyone would, hard evidence that it is not the case, that it cannot and should not be done. All right, well, next up on tonight's podcast, if you or someone close to you has recently suffered from a stroke, I definitely want you to listen up to this next item, because it's a study that examines the risk and risk factors for depression in people who have suffered stroke. During the first 3 months after having a stroke, the risk for depression is 8 times higher than in a reference population of people who had not had a stroke, according to an article published online by Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry. More than 10 million people had a stroke in 2013, and more than 30 million people worldwide live with a stroke diagnosis. Researchers used data linked from 7 Danish nationwide registries to examine how risk and risk factors for depression differ between patients with a stroke and a reference population without having had a stroke, as well as how the added factor of depression influences death, in other words, mortality rates in this population. Among 135,417 patients with a stroke, 34,346, or 25.4%, just over a quarter, had a diagnosis of depression within 2 years after their stroke, and more than half of the cases of depression, 17,690, appeared in the first 3 months after the stroke. So already we know that there is going to be likely depression in at least a quarter of people who suffer from stroke. And among those, at least half, it's going to happen within the first 3 months after the stroke. In a reference population of 145,499 people without stroke, 11,330, or 7.8%, had a depression diagnosis within 2 years after entering the study, and less than a quarter of those cases appeared within the first 3 months. So a markedly higher number of patients with depression who have had a stroke compared to those who had not. The risk of depression in patients during the first 3 months after stroke was in fact 8 times higher than in the reference population without stroke. Major risk factors for depression for patients after a stroke and in the reference population too were older age, female, living alone, basic education attainment, also suffering from diabetes. We know from lots of other studies that diabetes is a risk factor for depression. A high level of somatic comorbidity. Well, what does that mean? Somatic just refers to the body, comorbidity, other illnesses. So if they have other medical problems, I would speculate also they're specifically talking about chronic pain syndromes, maybe arthritis, lower back pain, things like that. Also a previous history of depression, that's fairly obvious. And in the patients with stroke, the severity of the stroke was also a risk factor for depression. In other words, how much disability the stroke caused, paralysis, loss of speech, things like that. In both groups, patients with stroke and the reference population without stroke, depressed individuals, especially those who had a new onset of depression, had increased risk of death from all causes. Depression is common in patients with stroke during the first year. Those with prior depression or severe stroke are especially at risk because a large number of deaths can be attributable to depression after stroke. Clinicians should be aware of the risk. Okay, so bottom line, the take-home message, someone who's had a stroke needs to be screened carefully for depression and treat it, especially the screening during the first few months after the stroke. All right, we're going to be back with more after this commercial break on Psychiatry Today with Dr. Scott.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Perhaps you are struggling to cope with the disease of addiction. If not, you probably know a family member or friend that needs help in battling the cravings and the personal and professional damage done by the effects of drugs or alcohol. Get a pen and paper and be ready to write down the following. These are the issues that the trained staff at the Atlanta Healing Center address and treat every day. Their doctors and counselors with over 40 years of practice in the field of addiction can treat the suffering individual in a thoughtful, compassionate, and experienced manner and guide him or her along the path to recovery. So call 770-696-9862 and speak to a knowledgeable staff member about how you or your loved one can be helped to enjoy a better and healthier life. More information is also available on the website at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
America's Web Radio is the most diverse and informative radio station anywhere in cyberspace. We have shows about health, business, current events, entertainment, home care, and everything in between. We appreciate your continued support of America's Web Radio.
Welcome back to Psychiatry Today with your host, Dr. Scott Bay, your psychiatrist with all the latest mental health-related news. Postpartum depression is certainly a very serious mental health problem. It not only seriously affects the health of a woman who's recently given birth, but it certainly has health consequences for the woman's newborn child if she is impaired by her illness and not able to take care of the child as well as she might have otherwise. And so I found a couple of articles recently about specific risk factors for postpartum depression, and hopefully this new information will help doctors screen women for postpartum depression. And really, I think the screening really should be done on a number of fronts. The OBGYNs who see a woman for their post-birth checkups should screen for postpartum depression. The pediatricians who see the mother with the newborn child for the newborn child's early well child checkups should also be considered competent to screen the mother for postpartum depression, even though the mother, strictly speaking, is not their patient. Of course, if they found it to be the case, they wouldn't treat the mother themselves. They would refer the mother back to their OBGYN or their primary care physician, who should also be able to and be screening women who've recently given birth for postpartum depression. But it's good to have studies like these two I'm about to go over with you that give us clues as to what are specific factors that increase the risk for it. Research presented at this year's World Congress of Anesthesiologists in Hong Kong, that was the end of August, beginning of September, shows that women who experience persistent childbirth pain are more likely to develop postpartum depression following the birth of their child. Postpartum depression affects about 10 to 15% of women worldwide, resulting in significant morbidity and poor maternal and neonatal health outcomes. And it's associated with long-term psychological and social and economic impact. The new study investigated the effects of persistent childbirth pain, psychological pain, and pain vulnerability. The authors conducted a cohort study involving 200 healthy women who received epidural pain relief during the deliveries of their firstborns. Psychological vulnerability was assessed using the perceived stress scale and the pain catastrophizing scale. A phone survey was conducted 6 to 8 weeks after childbirth to assess the presence of persistent childbirth pain and anxiety status using a pain questionnaire and the Spielberger State Trait Anxiety Inventory. Postpartum depression was evaluated using the well-established and long-used Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale. Modeling was then used to identify any possible association with childbirth pain. A total of 138 women were included in the analysis. The incidence of postpartum depression after 4 weeks giving birth was 5.8%. Patients with persistent pain, that is, pain that went on more than 4 weeks after giving birth, had significantly higher scores on the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale as compared to patients whose pain resolved by 4 weeks by a difference of 2.44 mean score, and compared to patients who had never had pain postpartum by a difference of 4.07 mean score. Other significant factors that were associated with the higher Edinburgh postnatal depression scale scores were higher levels of stress, greater pain vulnerability during pregnancy, and a higher level of anxiety at 6 to 8 weeks postpartum. The authors concluded that greater pain vulnerability and stress during pregnancy and presence of persistent pain or higher anxiety during the postpartum period are positively associated with scores on these postpartum depression tests. The research findings support the need to address pain comprehensively to lessen the risk of developing postpartum depression, and a larger study is being conducted to evaluate the impact of pain and postpartum depression in pregnant women. Well, so I think the important take-home portion of the study, to get away from the mundane details of the statistics, is that women who are in pain more than 4 weeks after giving birth are at greater risk for postpartum depression. And certainly, I think the author's conclusion that paying more attention to treating this pain is warranted and is likely to help prevent the onset of postpartum depression. However, what the article about this research doesn't mention, but a thought that occurs to me is, well, how do you go about treating this pain? Keep in mind, a good percentage of these women are going to be nursing, so whatever pain medication they're taking is going to wind up in their breast milk to some degree or another, and what effect is that going to have on their newborn child? On the other hand, without adequately treating the pain and letting the woman fall into a state of depression, she's certainly going to suffer in terms of her ability to care for and nurture her child. So the factors definitely need to be weighed against each other. Now, the next article has to do with a different risk factor for postpartum depression. It's premature birth. Research has shown that mothers of infants born prematurely have almost double the rates of postpartum depression, particularly during their time in the neonatal intensive care unit. Research from Brown University showed that there are certain social and emotional factors that further increase the risk of postpartum depression in mothers of preterm infants. The research is titled Social Emotional Factors Increase Risk of Postpartum Depression in Mothers of Preterm Infants, and it's been published in the Journal of Pediatrics. Mothers with a previous mental health disorder and mothers experiencing negative perceptions of themselves and their infant at the time of discharge from the neonatal intensive care unit were at increased risk for depression 1 month post-discharge, regardless of the infant's gestational age at birth. That is, regardless of how much or little the premature birth was compared to the normal full term. The study included 724 mothers of preterm infants who were cared for more than 5 days in the neonatal intensive care unit and participated in what was called a transition home program. Families in the program received enhanced support and education about their infants from former neonatal ICU parents trained as family resource specialists. Participants completed an evaluation prior to discharge from the neonatal ICU to determine their perceptions of neonatal ICU staff support, infant well-being, maternal well-being, as measured by emotional readiness and competency, and maternal comfort as measured by worry about her infant. Mental health history and social risk factors were also obtained by the researchers. At 1 month post-discharge, the aforementioned Edinburgh postnatal depression scale was administered. That's the same scale that was used in the study we talked about previously, the one that found that prolonged post-childbirth pain was a risk factor for postpartum depression. Mothers of early, moderate, and late preterm infants reported similar rates of possible depression. That is, early preterm infants, 20% postpartum depression. Moderate preterm infants, 22% postpartum depression. And late preterm infants, 18%. These are the reported rates 1 month after discharge from neonatal ICU. So pretty much all around that 20% ballpark figure. A history of mental health disorder, decreased perception of maternal well-being, decreased maternal comfort regarding her infant, and decreased perception of family cohesion were also associated with possible depression at 1 month post-discharge. A comprehensive mental health assessment prior to discharge is essential to identify women at risk and provide appropriate referrals. Comprehensive transition home assessment and interventions to reduce anxiety and bolster maternal mental health confidence and readiness, along with post-discharge assessment, are needed to identify, treat, and support mothers of preterm infants. So there you have it. Two research studies giving doctors clues as to what may be additional risk factors for postpartum depression that should trigger extra screening and scrutiny for that illness. The first one, again, persistent pain more than 4 weeks after childbirth. The second, having had a preterm infant. There are certainly others. It's not as if doctors can say that a normal birth that proceeded without any complications at the normal time of gestation and without any abnormal persistent pain precludes any risk for postpartum depression. There are other issues. Are there a lot of psychosocial stresses in the woman's life, problems in the relationship with their partner or the lack of one, for example? So really all women should be screened, but the women with these other problems should deserve even more close screening. All right, we're going to take another break, and we'll be back with more mental health-related news on Psychiatry Today with Dr. Scott.
Your auto love and investment demands the best, and for 45 years, Passport Transport has been meeting those demands. From manufacturers to the one-car collectors and all other facets of the auto industry and antique auto hobby. The first and the finest with unequaled service and peace of mind. Passport Transport, your auto transportation company. Contact PassportTransport.com with your need today. Passport Transport.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
America's Web Radio is the most diverse and informative radio station anywhere in cyberspace. We have shows about health, business, current events, entertainment, home care, and everything in between. We appreciate your continued support of America's Web Radio.
Welcome back to Psychiatry Today with your host, Dr. Scott Bay, your psychiatrist, bringing you all the latest mental health-related news. You know, in years past, I can recall talking to you about the results of surveys about driving behavior on the roads, and that unfortunately, our own Atlanta metro area would often rank high on those surveys in terms of angry drivers. Haven't seen those surveys. Maybe it's not making it into the paper for some reason. Maybe people don't like hearing about it. But in any case, I saw a study about anger and driving, and that angry drivers have a higher risk of collisions. Shouldn't really come as a surprise, but I've always had my own take on how to avoid or alleviate road rage, as it were, and I'll give you that when I'm done reviewing this latest research for you. But it turns out that angry, aggressive drivers have much higher odds of being in a motor vehicle collision than those who don't get angry while driving. And this new study was done by Canada's Center for Addiction and Mental Health. Even what they called minor aggression, such as swearing, yelling, or making rude gestures, can increase the risk of a collision. And the study was published in a journal called Transportation Research, Traffic Psychology and Behavior. Nearly one-third of Ontario drivers reported acts of minor aggression. You would have to imagine the rates would probably be fairly comparable here in the States. Drivers who said they had also made threats, attempted or succeeded in damaging another car or hurting someone had the highest odds of collision, 78% higher than those whose aggression was considered minor. Wow, that's pretty scary that you get to actually to the point of hurting someone or damaging another car. That's when the cops are called and when really bad things have happened, including, sadly, here on our own highways in Metro Atlanta, stabbings, shootings. Now, the risk that they found in people who make these aggressive, angry acts is comparable, as far as the risk of collisions, comparable to the risk of people who use cannabis and drive. That's a whole other story. We can talk about that some other time, but yes, using cannabis and driving can increase the risk of collisions. Well, getting back to this study, the findings were drawn from the Canada's Addiction and Mental Health Center's Monitor, an ongoing survey of Ontario adults' mental health and risk behaviors using responses from 12,830 people between the years of 2002 and 2009. And while there has been research in the past that has explored the relationship between aggression and collisions, this is the largest population-level study to analyze this association. Just under 8% of Ontarians reported having a car collision in the previous year. This group was analyzed in relation to their reported aggressive behavior, while controlling for other factors that could increase the risk of collision, such as age, sex, cannabis or alcohol use, and other factors. It was striking how the risk of collision rose as the levels of aggression increased. People who reported no driving-related aggression had the lowest odds of collision, with increasing risk among those who had minor aggression, and the highest risk of all among those who reported both minor and more serious aggression. The results clearly show that aggression is related to the risk of collision. And while the study doesn't show that specific cases of anger directly caused a collision, the strong association suggests these drivers may have a greater chance of a collision because they either drive more aggressively or are distracted by their anger from other hazards on the road. Reducing driver anger and aggression would therefore potentially reduce the risk of collisions, and the authors state there are well-established approaches to manage stress and anger, ranging from deep breathing techniques and listening to music to cognitive anger management programs, leaving enough time on a car trip to reach your destination could also reduce stress. Yes, good luck with that. Good luck with taking an angry, chronically angry and chronically aggressive driver and telling them, look, you know, you need to take anger management classes. You need to do deep breathing and reduce your level of stress. Don't get me wrong. Not that they shouldn't be told these things, but people like that often are not so amenable to suggestions like that to change their behavior, let's face it. Now, I promised you I would give you my own formula for reducing road rage. It's really, really very simple. It's just an idea that when you get behind the wheel, before you turn on the car, you basically just think about all you want to do is get where you're going without getting a traffic ticket or getting into an accident. That's it. Just keep those things uppermost in your mind. No tickets, no wrecks. You notice I didn't say anything at all about getting there on time. If you're putting pressure on yourself to get someplace at a certain time, then that's going to increase the risk of stress and frustration and anger when you inevitably come across delays from traffic or construction or slow drivers, what have you. So that's out. And any notion of trying to get where you're going on time also is out in Metro Atlanta, Georgia, as you know. And I know there are other places where the traffic is just as bad, if not worse. LA, for example. You notice my recommendation also didn't include anything about getting where you were going without encountering drivers who are themselves aggressive or rude or abusive or simply incompetent and causing you to have to make some adjustment, no matter how minor, during your trip. I think you have to take that is as a given, that those things are going to happen to you, and you should not get so upset or disappointed when they do. In other words, it's about lowering your expectations. All you want to do is avoid the major hassles of a wreck with at least being stuck for a while you get police to come take a report, and at worst, having lost your car or life and limb, God forbid. And then you also remove the other major hassle. You went too fast because you were in a hurry or you committed some other violation, again, to get where you're going, or perhaps in response to some other driver, and you get pulled over for a ticket, which is a major hassle, loss of time, and an expense. So as long as you can avoid those two major issues, let the rest go. Never mind worrying about getting there on time. Just get there safe and without that traffic ticket, speeding ticket, what have you. By lowering one's expectations, it's going to reduce the possibility that you're going to be stressed getting where you're going, and especially that you're going to get angry when you meet with those frustrations that typically happen on the road. So there you have it. That's my recipe for avoiding road rage, just the mantra, no tickets, no wrecks. Now, hopefully that will help somebody out there get to where they're going in a calmer fashion. Next up on Psychiatry Today, a very interesting article about how some scientists have found a way using a specific technique in an MRI scanner to actually influence people's feelings or thoughts. Now, if that very brief sketchy description I just gave you gives you kind of a creep factor about, wow, scientists can actually alter people's feelings and thoughts? Yes, that was my reaction exactly. There is a significant creep factor to that, and we're going to get to that. But overall, that doesn't change the fact that what the scientists did with the technology that is already readily available is really fascinating, and it gives us a lot of insights into how the mind and the brain work and regulation of emotions. So let's get started talking about that. What happened was scientists induced feelings about faces. Volunteers who started an experiment feeling neutral about certain faces, that is, pictures of certain faces they saw, ended up unknowingly adopting the feelings that scientists induced via an MRI feedback technique. The study was published in the journal PLOS Biology. It suggests that there is a single region of the brain where both positive and negative feelings for faces take shape. And don't think that sounds far-fetched. The brain does have specific areas for recognizing faces and even specific expressions of faces. And you can see changes in the functioning of these areas in people who have had strokes and so on. And the study also provides the second demonstration this year that this MRI technique can be used to train a mental process in an unknowing subject. Again, a little bit scary, right? This spring, this team used the same method to associate the perception of color with the context of a pattern so strongly that the volunteers saw the color when cued by the pattern, even if the color wasn't really there. That is really altering perception and thought in a very interesting way. All right, we're going to take a commercial break and get into the details of the new study. You're listening to Psychiatry Today with Dr. Scott. Be right back.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
America's Web Radio is the most diverse and informative radio station anywhere in cyberspace. We have shows about health, business, current events, entertainment, home care, and everything in between. We appreciate your continued support of America's Web Radio.
Welcome back to Psychiatry Today with your host, Dr. Scott Bay, your psychiatrist, bringing you all the latest mental health-related news. And now we are talking about a study from Brown University where scientists have taken unknowing volunteers and, using techniques from an MRI scanner, have gotten them to alter their thoughts in a certain way. In this case, about how they felt about looking at pictures of certain faces. In this new study, researchers sought to determine whether they could direct feelings about faces, a more sophisticated brain function that is closer to their eventual goal, which is to develop the technique to the point where it could become a tool for psychological therapy, for instance, for anxiety, that is to say, the treatment of anxiety. Face recognition is a very important social function for people, and facial recognition is associated with people's emotions. The technique, which the researchers call DECNEF, for decoded neurofeedback, starts with detecting and analyzing the specific activity patterns in a brain region that correspond to a mental state in the subject. For example, at the beginning of the new study, while 24 volunteers saw pictures of hundreds of faces and rated their feelings about each of them on a scale of 1 for dislike to 10 for like, with 5 for neutral, while they're doing that, the researchers used the MRI scanner to record the patterns of activity in a brain region called the cingulate cortex. That step alone was fairly conventional neuroscience, except that many scientists believe that positive or negative feelings about faces are formulated in separate brain regions. But this team of 4 researchers at Brown University and the Advanced Telecommunications Research Institute International in Kyoto, Japan, wanted to test whether the cingulate cortex handles both sides of the emotion. Sure enough, the researchers' software, called a decoder, was able to analyze the recordings to identify reliable and distinct patterns in each volunteer's cingulate cortex associated with either positive and or negative feelings about faces. So again, what they're doing is they're using the MRI scanner, they're decoding the neural signals from that part of the brain using specific software to analyze these signals to say, oh, okay, this is how it looks when someone is feeling positively about a picture of a face that they're looking at, and this is this subject's pattern when they're looking at a face and it's a negative feeling. Now, they found that the cingulate cortex, again, this is the area of the brain they're focusing on, seems to handle both opposing directions, feeling positively or negatively about a face, with different, distinct activity patterns. Now, the explanation of how the study was done is hard to follow, but bear with me and I'll try to make it easier to follow. So having established these 2 signature patterns for each volunteer, in other words, this is what this subject's cingulate cortex looks like when they're feeling positively about a picture of a face, and this is what it looks like when they're feeling negatively about it, the participants were then unknowingly divided into 2 groups of 12, either positive or negative. And they were called back in for a few days of additional research in the MRI machine. In this phase, the subjects were shown a subset of the faces they rated as neutral, and then they were asked to perform a seemingly unrelated task. After seeing each face on the screen, they were then shown a disc and asked to somehow use their minds to try to make it appear as big as possible. The bigger they could make the disc, they were told, the more of a small monetary reward they could receive. In reality, the tasks weren't unrelated. Participants didn't know this at the time, but the only way the disc would grow was when the MRI readings showed that they happened, for whatever reason, to produce this signature pattern of either positive or negative feelings about the faces in their cingulate cortex. In other words, the experiment rewarded volunteers in the positive group with a larger disc when they produced this pattern associated with liking the faces after seeing a previously neutral one. Similarly, the experiment rewarded volunteers in the negative group with a growing disc the more they happened to produce the pattern associated with dislike after seeing a neutral one. In essence, this DECNEF aims to train people to produce specific feelings or perceptions in specific contexts by rewarding those moments when they unknowingly do so. A third group of six other participants was used as a control group. They saw faces and rated them, but were not given the DECNEF step of having to enlarge a disc in association with the activation patterns that represent positive or negative feelings. Finally, all the participants were then queried anew about their feelings regarding the initially neutral faces. When the researchers analyzed the results, they were able to make several key findings. On average, the positive group's ratings of the neutral faces moved up mildly but significantly by about 0.6 on the 1 to 10 scale, while the negative group's ratings of the faces moved down a bit less but still significantly. Meanwhile, the control group's ratings didn't change significantly at all. So let's try to make sense of this so far before we move on to the rest of the description of the results. First, the scientists got a picture of what's the brain pattern or the pattern of neural activity in the cingulate cortex when someone is thinking positively about a face versus someone who's thinking negatively about a face. Then they gave the subjects an unrelated task to get them to trigger this same pattern in the cortex. Doing so would influence their feelings about a picture of a face that was previously neutral and subsequent to this intervention, either positive or negative. So using this intervention, they were able to get the subjects to change how they felt about a picture of a face. Agreeably, not in a drastic fashion, like they didn't go suddenly from negative to positive. They went from neutral to slightly positive and neutral to very slightly negative. But there was still a change. Now, from all these results, researchers conclude that the association of originally neutrally rated faces with the covert induction of activity patterns in the single brain region, the cingulate cortex, led to changes in facial preference specifically for those faces and in a specific preference, positive or negative direction. To be as certain as possible about the findings, they did a few more analyses. In post-experiment interviews, they asked the subjects whether they knew what was really going on. Not surprisingly, none of them did. Then the researchers explained what the experiment really was about and asked people to say whether they thought they were in the positive or the negative group. And people were no better than chance at saying which they were in. Chance meaning 50-50, just the flip of a coin. Together, these results suggest that none of the experimental volunteers changed their preferences about neutral faces based on their own will or intention, and therefore the results could be attributed to the experimenters' interventions. In another analysis, researchers crunched the numbers to see if the degree of activity in the cingulate cortex during this disc enlargement phase correlated with the degree of change in preferences. The results revealed a high correlation. In other words, the amount of brain activity was proportional to the amount of induced feeling. And while the induced changes in feeling were very mild, the training took place only over a few days. Training that occurred on the scale of weeks, as is often required for clinical therapies. For example, your course of cognitive behavioral therapy is typically supposed to take 12 weeks. That might have induced stronger changes in feelings. But even a small effect could be beneficial for people if it blunts a persistently painful feeling associated with a certain trigger. And that's the key. If someone develops a traumatic memory that makes him or her suffer, even a small reduction of the suffering would be helpful. So that's one way in which this method could be used to help people. Now, the researchers said they were aware that there could be potential abuse or misuse of the technique, a kind of brainwashing. So it might be good if it proves at least somewhat limited in its effect. So at least they acknowledge the potential creep factor of these findings. Hopefully if the technique were developed further and it were used to apply it to people who suffered from anxiety to try to reduce their anxiety, let's say people who have post-traumatic stress disorder or phobias, for example, that there would be some way to regulate its use so that there were no people who could use it in a nefarious way. Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up tonight's podcast. I hope that you found the information that I enjoyed bringing to you to be somewhat interesting and informative. And above all else, I hope that until we get together again next time, you have a wonderful, stress-free week. But if not, then you need to call Dr. Scott. Good night, and thanks for listening.
America's Web Radio is the most diverse and informative radio station anywhere in cyberspace. We have shows about health, business, current events, entertainment, home care, and everything in between. We appreciate your continued support of America's Web Radio.